Well, good morning and welcome to our Teneo Insights call. We're just over a month away from the US election. The decision over who is going to be president always matters, but this one really matters. America stands at a fork in the road. Turn left to Joe Biden or stick right, or at least populist, with Donald Trump. But if you were hoping to get some idea of the policy differences between the two men, you'd have been sorely disappointed by Tuesday night's debate. By common consent, it was the lowest, angriest standoff between two presidential candidates ever. It was way more heat than light, with one commentator saying he'd seen more civilized catfights. I woke up to a series of messages from American friends, Republican and Democrat, all saying they were embarrassed by the whole affair. For me, the main story that came out of it was that the incumbent made clear there were only two outcomes he could foresee. First, he won. Second, the election was stolen from him, raising the prospect of weeks of chaos as he disputes the result. So how can we make sense of it all? How should business prepare when the outcome is so uncertain? Does it matter that Donald Trump spent 100 times more on his haircuts in 2016 than he did on taxes, or that his opponent is 77 and would be 81 if he ran for a second term? We have the perfect panel to answer these questions. Mark Thompson will give his insights that he gained from his years as a British president and CEO of the New York Times, which found itself in more than one row with Donald Trump. Sarah Baxter has been a major figure at the Sunday Times for many years and is in the US covering the most important of elections. Tony Saeg was a senior communications advisor for Donald Trump. He'll be looking at the Republican strategy. Lawson Porter was a senior communications advisor to Barack Obama. He'll tell us about the Democrat strategy. Each of them is up early this morning. I'm feeling very guilty about this. It's 6 a.m. on the East Coast where they all are. So a major thank you to all of them, and I hope you've got lots of coffee. Before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, apart from Sarah Baxter, please hang up. This isn't intended for outside broadcast or publication. So that done, let's get to it. Mark Thompson, I'm going to start with you. You've been an outsider running one of America's most famous media institutions. What insight has that given to you into this election?
Good morning, Craig and everyone. Look, a couple of caveats. Firstly, I think without question the least qualified person on this call to talk about any of this. If I've got any value at all, it's because I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm not a political person. I had politics knocked out of me for a couple of decades at the BBC, three decades at the BBC. So to take everything, this is an amateur contributions. Secondly, I'm very apprised of the fact that in 2016, it was very easy for journalists to misread what was going on. You know, it's very easy to list all sorts of probably correct trends and facts about an emerging election. It's fantastically hard to gross them up into a prediction of what's going to happen. As it happens, I thought Trump was going to win in 2016, but I was absolutely in a minority inside the New York Times saying that. So I'm very humble about our ability at this stage to figure it out. But let me have a go anyway about what's going on. And I don't want to over-rotate on the first on the first debate. These televised debates have historically pretty rarely made a big difference. They've very heavily watched. This one was not watched as much as the first debate in 2016, but they're extensively watched and covered. The media and analysts, of course, then over-rotate to try and, as it were, call the entire thing on the basis of one television night. We don't know whether it's going to be significant or not. And on balance, I don't think that's significant. The fundamental facts for me of this election is you've got a contest. If we talk about the Democrats first, the Democrats have, despite everything that's happened, 4 years after putting up Hillary Clinton, have put up another establishment figure. A man who comes across, the good thing to say, is more user-friendly, and arguably many people disagree with this characterization, but it's a fact that I think many Americans got it, less patronizing to some Americans. His ability to connect, I think that the obviously rehearsed but still quite effective moments in the debate when Biden turns directly to the camera and addresses the American people. Trump never did that. Trump was, as it were, always in the particular bubble of the argument and his own sense of resentment of being misunderstood, the kind of conspiracy against him. Biden is trying to reach out of that. And although he can get policy points across, particularly because it was very difficult to do that in that environment, he does reach out reasonably well, but he's an establishment figure. He's not a strong performer by any standards. He was okay, I thought, in this first debate, but he's not a strong performer. And he's against this extraordinary maverick performer who arguably had a bad night, or at least a night when the tactics were, you know, kind of, you know, so far out of what is normally expected, but they're crazy. I mean, Trump is a great communicator, and you never want to completely write off even crazy tactics. But it was an odd, moody night for me of a president who knows correctly that he's in some difficulty and is fighting for a way through those difficulties back towards victory. It's not clear to me yet he's found the solutions, but you know, where are we? I mean, the 538, you know, kind of average polls would put Biden, I think, about 7.5% ahead at the moment in the country. Some people claim that that's, as it were, that's a lead which is much bigger than the margin of error, that if there was a similar misreading of the polls as happened in 2016, if you want to define it like that, that Biden would still win. I have to say they're the same people who assured us that Trump couldn't win in 2016, by and large, and I take that with a pinch of salt. I would have thought we can expect these polls to close, though. I think law and order is a strong card for the president to play. And I think out there are many people who, in British political terms, you'd call shy Tories. In other words, people who may well think it's socially unpopular to say they're going to vote for President Trump, but who in the sanctity of the mail-in ballot or the actual moment of voting in person will actually go for the president because of their fears for stability in the country. Against that, the messiness of the COVID response, the other side of the law and order ticket, in other words, who is, you know, who is responsible for the divisiveness that's leading to violence in the streets. Genuine and I think very deep outrage around George Floyd and everything that's followed from that in the Black Lives Movement, and that outrage extending far beyond traditional radical left groups more deeply into the country, and a kind of broader sense of, can't we get back to, in this very, very apocalyptic, strange year, can't we get back to some sort of normality, may shift the suburbs, back towards the centre. The Greek Prime Minister's got a line about the revenge of the centre, that in many countries after years of a noisy populist experiment, maybe this is a time when voters want to get back to some kind of normality. I think it's untested, and in my polling of my Times colleagues last night, this is a very, very small unrepresentative poll, they are, I would say, by no means clear about what's going to happen. When I spoke to you, Craig, in preparation for this 10 days, 2 weeks ago, I thought that Trump would probably edge it. I feel less certain now. That's not really the debate, but more the sense that, looking at Trump, he himself looks to me angry and troubled. And because there's no filter, is already externalizing these scenarios about what happens when he actually loses the popular vote or it's too close to call. He does not look like a confident, in control candidate in a way that he did amazingly in 2016. He was the most confident candidate and he won because he was the most confident. Very close, I think. So very interesting.
Very interesting. Thank you, Mark. I think Tony will have a lot to say about that when we come to him shortly. I'm going to come to you next, though, Sarah. You know, you are getting really into the thick of it. You've been spending time in Ohio and you're currently in Philadelphia. What are you seeing on the ground there?
Well, it's very interesting, Craig. I'm actually in Pennsylvania. I'm not in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is very heavily Democrat, as indeed was Cleveland, Ohio last week. I'm actually staying in Trump land, in the heart of the old white working class areas, which shocked everybody in 2016 when they flipped for the first time ever to Trump. And I got to tell you, they're sticking by him. I mean, in the town where I am, I'm living among a sea of Trump-Pence flags, very few Biden signs, and as a general rule, the wealthier the house, the more likely the Biden sign. And that's kind of odd, you know, it's not what we're used to. And, you know, I'm hearing a lot about the blowout support for Joe Biden in the suburbs, but the that sort of disenfranchised right working class vote seems to be sticking to Trump. And they have some good economic reasons too in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, which is a state that has benefited enormously from the fracking, the shale revolution. Lots of jobs came in that wake. And they feel their economic prospects are better with Donald Trump. And poll after poll shows that the country tends to think that too. Now, personally, I'm not a big fan of the president. Certainly, I would put myself in the category of people who, in 2016, certainly hoped Hillary would win, and actually thought at the time of the grab 'em by the pussy tape that women in the suburbs, the sort of, you know, the nice, decent women who were trying to bring up their families in a very decent way, would reject that very blatant indecency. And, you know, a lot of them didn't. So I'm quite sobered by my own experience of 2016. And I've got to say that Pennsylvania, to me, does not feel, it's such an important battleground state, does not look, feel to me like it is comfortably 8 or 9 points ahead for Joe Biden, which is what the most recent polls put the figure at. That said, Joe Biden has many advantages over Hillary Clinton. He's by no means as divisive a figure as Mark Thompson says. There's virtually no third party challenge to peel away votes. And Trump is finding it very hard to get to 50% of the vote. He's really always stuck with most of the electorate disapproving of him. Joe Biden's also had a good week. Mark Thompson's been characteristically modest, but it's been a stunning week for the New York Times, which had that great scoop about Trump only paying $750 at most a year in taxes, and which is a lot more than most people pay, but not less than most people pay in a month. And Joe Biden, by and large, had a good debate. He looked like Methuselah. He looked ancient, but he didn't have a senior moment. And the main thing for Joe Biden was to continue to hold his polling advantage. And from that point of view, he's had a good week because he's come out of a testing week pretty much where he was at the start. I don't think the debate changed a lot of minds, but it also didn't lose him any support. So, and he needed to reassure the electorate that he was capable of being president. And he sort of did that. He kind of passed that low bar. Now, Trump probably should have looked a bit more presidential. We saw him trying to be more presidential, more reaching out to all Americans in his convention. And that was obviously more heavily staged, more heavily scripted. That worked. Here, he's falling back on his base. And to some extent, I understand his strategy because his base is much more energized than Joe Biden's. His base still loves him, and they're going to turn out for him. And it's very important for Trump, given that he can't really reach 50% of the actual vote, that he turns out as many supporters as he can and retain his Electoral College advantage, which he had in 2016. So he's trying to energize his own side, but I think he overdid it. I mean, I think the white supremacy thing was a big error. I actually met the Proud Boys in Cleveland last weekend, and I'm actually going to be writing about it this weekend. I met them too late to file for the Sunday Times last week. But, you know, they do see it themselves as the security wing of the Trump movement, and they're out there. I just ran into them attending a sort of pickup truck rally for Trump, and they were there. And they told me they were out in Cleveland on debate night in case there were any trouble or anything. They've been very validated and empowered by what Trump had to say about, you know, stand back, sure, but also stand by. And they're taking that as a message to also interfere should there be any challenge to the electoral, you know, to the vote on November the 3rd. So, and I think that harks back to Trump in Charlottesville, where he suffered a lot in the polls temporarily because of his sort of very, you know, on the one hand, on the other, they're all fine people argument at an actual, you know, about a neo-Nazi rally. So I agree very much with Mark that Trump is looking a little bit like the underdog, but we know how good he is as an underdog. He's still out there fighting. He sometimes looks like he's trying a lot harder than Joe Biden to win this thing. Joe Biden's team is campaigning remotely. They're all behind their masks. They're not knocking on doors. They're not canvassing. They're not holding rallies. Trump's got the energy advantage. And maybe in a tight election, that's going to count.
Sarah, thank you very much, and forgive my senior moment on where you actually are. I'm going to go to Tony next. Tony, you must end up in lots of forums like this where there's lots of people who are metropolitan liberals all talking about what's going on, and I suspect it winds you up a bit. Give us both barrels on why Trump is going to win.
Craig, thank you, and it's great to be with all of you this morning. And you know, there is much of the analysis up until my presentation now that I do agree with. I think Sarah is right. There is a large enthusiasm gap between the two candidates, which matters. And I'm not sure the lessons of 2016 have totally been learned, certainly not by the echo chamber of the coastal elites in the United States and the media elites, who largely discount the connection Donald Trump has with a huge part of this country and the American people. And, you know, I just want to, before I go into it, address a couple things that have been said. Craig, first and foremost, there have been three candidates in the last 20 years who have refused to concede on election night, and they've all been Democrats. You know, you had Al Gore refuse to concede in 2000. You had, obviously, John Kerry refuse to concede on election night in 2004. And you obviously had Hillary Clinton refuse to concede on election night in 2016. So I think what the president is saying is there are very legitimate concerns that in some states, because these are state-by-state laws on the mail-in ballot, you can have scenarios in my home state of New York where you still have ballots that were cast in primary elections that are being evaluated. In some of our congressional primaries, we didn't have winners confirmed for weeks after because of the heavy volume of mail-ins because of COVID concerns. And some of these state laws are very lax on the integrity of that ballot. So that's what I think the president really is concerned about. And we all should be, because it should be one person, one vote. And we should all be equally concerned about fraud. But here's what people misunderstand. Donald Trump, even though he is the president, and he's the only candidate I could imagine, maybe since Reagan in 84, who, even though he's the incumbent president, is still the outsider. And he runs as the outsider. And he connects with people as the outsider and the disruptor. So this kind of notion that he's going to all of a sudden just start following rules, the establishment rules, that frankly are set up to beat him, to minimize his impact, I think it's just not going to happen. And even if you look at how he's governed, and you know, there's a lot to be said about his style and whether you appreciate or like his style. But I mean, he's had a very productive, take the qualitative analysis out of whether you agree or disagree with the quality of the legislation or the policy, but he's had a very productive 4 years in a city largely marked by gridlock, Washington. And he's done things that have not been done in quite a long time. First time in 31 years we have tax reform. He's renegotiated major trade deals with Canada, Mexico, China, South Korea. He's completely deregulated, you know, an overburdensome regulatory environment that's led to some of the best business environment in this country and best job growth pre-COVID. Energy dominance. I mean, you know, Sarah's absolutely right. You have states like Pennsylvania, you know, Eastern Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, parts of this country that are finally really experiencing energy independence and liberation and able to really benefit from that economically speaking. If you look at the Middle East, I think that's probably one of the best examples. Maybe you've had this kind of global elite mentality of how to bring Middle East peace. Well, it hasn't really worked in quite a long time. Donald Trump, you know, very unpopular with the rest of the world, moves the embassy to Jerusalem. Very unpopular with the rest of the world, pulls out of the Iran deal, which, you know, from the American perspective, I think was a very flawed deal. But what did that do? That coalesced, you know, the Sunnis around this notion that the United States was really serious about changing the order in the Middle East, and it brought some significant advances in peace. So he'll always disrupt, but don't confuse disruption with lack of progress. And this is a president, and, you know, let's go to the debate for a second. But look, I think Donald Trump had the debate he wanted to have. He wanted to get all those things off his chest. He did. You know, my view kind of was, if he let Biden talk more, we probably would have been perceived as doing better, because I think Biden certainly was not wrong per se. And to the degree this is a parallel election. So to the degree this is a referendum on Donald Trump, you know, the good Trump versus the bad Trump, you know, that's a difficult race for us, just because of the polarized views toward Donald Trump as a person, not even his record, because his record, even from some of his most staunchest critics, especially when you look at the economy and foreign policy, it has been relatively strong. So the referendum is a tough thing for us, and he should not have made the debate necessarily more about him than about Joe Biden. When this becomes a choice, this becomes Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, it's a much tighter race, and it's a much more advantageous positioning for the president, because you can say, boy, I don't like that tweet, or I really wish he didn't say that, or, oh gosh, here we go again. But I'm going to vote for Joe Biden. 47 years. What has he really done? He looks a little, you know, absent and vacant from, you know, his own thoughts. Potentially he's going to be run by a very radical Democratic Party that is going to advance things that perhaps Joe Biden says he's not for. But if he ends up being president, the reality is he's going to be presiding over a far more progressive and liberal Democrat Party than existed even under Barack Obama. And is Joe Biden strong enough to fend them off and be this genuine centrist? I think there's a lot of doubt about that. So I'll go to the polling, and then I'll yield the floor to my great friend and colleague Orson, who's going to be wrong about everything he says, just letting you know in advance. Kidding. Absolutely kidding. but here's the problem with polls. Here's the problem with polls, aside from the view that many of us share, which is, at some point, polls, and this is without any offense meant to the media people on this call, at some point, especially these media organization polls, went from reflecting public opinion to reflecting their opinion of what public opinion should be. And that's why we discount them so heavily. And when you look at the methodology of a lot of these polls, I mean, there's no way you're going to get 34% Democrat turnout and 27% Republican turnout. Not going to happen, but that's what a lot of these polls in their methodology are modeling. So that's why you have this huge skew. So, you know, in Trump world, you know, we look at most polls very skeptically, but, you know, everyone has their number, right? So I've been in polling and strategy for a long time. I usually give Trump a +7 or +8 on top of any poll I see. So if he's down by 7, it's probably a tie. You know, if he's down by 8, he's down by 1. So you have to do your own kind of math when you look at some of these polls, because they are so heavily skewed. But in 2016, there were 165 or so public polls. 155 said Hillary Clinton was going to win. And, you know, there were very few of those outlier polls that captured what, you know, Mark said he saw and others, frankly, saw on the ground. And when I look at the Electoral College map, because this is an Electoral College contest, just to give some quick perspective, I think Pennsylvania, you know, where Sarah is right now, is probably the most important upper Midwest Rust Belt state. The big three are Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. If Donald Trump has to win one of those three to be reelected and keep the rest of his map, and the rest of the map looks very strong, and we're potentially adding, you know, Minnesota to that, at least competitively, that map. So I feel much better than the polls reflect. So this is a struggle. This is a battle. And look, Donald Trump thrives as the underdog. He really does. And I think you're going to see a real fight to the finish on his part. And when you look at the kinetic race, who's traveling, who's talking, who's campaigning, who's out there, I think the advantage on the ground there goes to the president. But I will yield to Orson, or actually back to you, Craig, and happy to take questions in a bit.
Thanks. Thanks, Tony. That was great. Also, the gauntlet has been laid down. A lot of people are speaking about that somebody's been passed over by his party a number of times. He's 77 years old. Is he really the candidate to win, or is he actually somebody that people could just vote for because they don't like Donald Trump?
Yes. I mean, you know, look at this. You know, people say the debate itself was a failure. But, you know, the Biden team announced yesterday, which I think is big news, that, you know, during the debate, the first 40 minutes, his campaign raised $10 million, which broke a record. So, you know, I think, you know, as everyone has clearly illustrated, the enthusiasm factor is hard to tell during COVID in the U.S., but, you know, the Supreme Court nomination has thrown another wave, or I should say wind, into this election. And that too, you know, sadly, the night Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, a lot of the Democratic Senate candidates, the DNC, and a lot of political PACs raised a record amount of money and continue to do so. So I think it's really hard to measure what exactly is going on. But what I can tell you, you know, it's 33 days before the election. As my old boss, President Clinton, once told me, you know, politics at its core is really simple. And it's simple math. It's, you know, you have to be able to add and not subtract. And the next 33 days, the candidate who masters that simple task of adding and not subtracting will probably win. All that to say that since September 18th, you know, nearly 1.5 billion ballots have already been cast. And I think Biden tried to speak to that in that Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, North Carolina, New Jersey, South Carolina, North Dakota, Virginia, Wisconsin are all voting at through absentee ballots, through early vote at record numbers. And, you know, a battleground state, not only for the presidential election, but a state like North Carolina has already cast and is kind of leading the way with 300,000 votes have been cast so far this cycle. And you compare that to 2016, before the election, there were only, you know, almost 10,000 votes cast. So what I'm trying to say is I think the polls, you're 100% right. I'm from Wisconsin. I drove from Milwaukee to Chicago to visit my grandmother, and it was 2 months before the election, and I immediately came back to D.C. and told everyone, those polls are wrong. Trump's going to win. I've never seen anything like that in Wisconsin as far as signs and the level of enthusiasm. But I think what is different in this go around, because of COVID, because of all the discussion on the early vote, is that, you know, I saw a statistic the other day that nearly 65 million people have already requested mail-in ballots. You know, it could be as high as 50 to 60% of the American public may have already voted before the election is done. So, you know, I think people underestimate that, and I think you see the president talk a lot about it. You see Democrats encouraging, and then also the thing that's, I think, pushing this in the real discussion in D.C. is the Senate races, which, you know, people say, you know, the presidential race is the most important. But if you walk down K Street, the thought of the Democrats controlling both chambers of Congress has more people up late night than who sits in the Oval Office. And a couple other things to toss out on what may happen on election night. You know, everyone asked about market reaction. I'll just go back. You know, the market yesterday in the U.S. Rebound and did fairly well. The market reaction in the U.S. after Trump won took a dip and then immediately went up. You know, I would argue that let's see what happens when the Democrats potentially win the Senate and control both chambers, and that may have a more of a lasting effect on the market reaction than anything else. The debate, one thing I think your audience may want to highlight is, and I found it really interesting, it gives you a preview of what's on voters' minds, is for the first time that I've ever seen, the issue of foreign policy was not a subject matter in the debates. It was race, it was economic, the economy, it was COVID and healthcare and law and order. And every poll that I've seen that people care about at the kitchen table kind of highlights that those are the core issues. So it will be interesting to see in the upcoming debates if the issue of foreign policy and trade come up. It would be interesting to see, you know, Trump was successful in bringing up China. But, you know, my point is that this election in the U.S. is solely focused on what people care about. And I'm sure Sarah can speak to that in Pennsylvania and what she's seeing. That's right there in front of them, and not necessarily anything that is across the big pond or anywhere else. Voters are keenly focused on how to put food on the table, how to make certain that their families are safe, and more importantly, should they get sick, should they pay for it? And going back to my earlier statement, the candidate that can close out these next 33 days and speak directly to that will win my who can add and who can subtract question.
Thank you, Austin. That was great. Just to remind people who are on the call, there is a Q&A function. So if you want to put your questions in there, it's just on the right-hand side of the screen. But I want to start with this idea that we might not get certainty in 33 days' time and the consequences of that, not the rights and wrongs of it. Mark, you with a businessman's hat, you were running a significantly sized business in the States. How worried should people be if there is a couple of months or a few weeks of uncertainty while there's a disputed result at a time of COVID and all the rest?
Well, look, I'm a kind of friendly foreigner living in the US. I had my green card interview yesterday. I'm planning to stay. And I've got a lot of faith in the US Constitution, actually. I mean, I think quite understandably in periods of disruption, people are terrified about whether the Constitution will hold. I suspect that despite all the wild talk, and, you know, honestly, irresponsible talk, in particular from the president, the sort of, you know, he's going to personally get the Supreme Court to kind of, in quotes, look at the ballots. You know? Sort of, you know, he doesn't like the result. It's not quite the way the system works. I suspect that the market and the business community will expect a result to emerge. I think it's highly likely it won't emerge on the night, or it certainly will. I mean, I think it's frankly almost unbelievable that there will be an accepted result on the night. And in other words, a landslide for one or the other candidate so great that there isn't grounds for doubt or challenge. But I think in a way we shouldn't take the noise of all of that for more than that, unless bluntly, as some people fear, violence breaks out on the streets and the armed groups of the right, but also it must be said, you know, some evidence of groups of the left also beginning to buy arms. That you start getting street fighting, you know, of a kind not seen in the country before. I regard that as being a lower threat than is often, you know, it kind of sensationally reported. But you can't rule out, given what we've already seen, the idea of a either disputed election or an election which is thought by some group or other to be false, leading to violence, and that clearly could freak everyone out. I mean, 2020 is a kind of apocalyptic year without this election because of COVID and the stresses and strains on the economy globally as well as in the US. And, you know, there are scenarios where that tips over into something truly horrendous. I think a more likely outcome is absolutely a disputed election, absolutely because of all the points that Tony made, this system which to a European seems absolutely insane of individual states having their own rules about an election which is meant to be an election for the entire country, and any number of oddities about the way it takes place, very unlike the way it plays out in the UK, that's bound to lead to noise and trouble. I still think it's very likely that there'll be an inauguration ceremony in early 2021 where one or other of these two gentlemen is sworn in and federal government continues as before. I mean, or at least it continues, as it were, constitutionally as before.
And Sarah, you're deliberately going very close to people out there, and you say you've met groups like the White, serious groups who are intent on causing trouble, that kind of thing. What's your sense of if there's more uncertainty for a number of weeks on top of COVID?
Well, I'm pretty worried about it, because I think that Donald Trump has made it absolutely clear that he will not accept the result if he loses. And in Pennsylvania, there are a lot of rows already over how to count the ballots and whether people are going to be disenfranchised by that. I'm actually an American citizen, and I'm trying to get registered to vote here. That's through my mother, by the way, if you think I don't sound like one. She's from Cleveland, where I was, and where the debate took place. And I'm finding it very difficult even to register to vote. So I'm beginning to have some sympathy with the voter suppression arguments that I've often heard. My main fear, though, is I'm sure Mark is right, we'll have a legitimate president duly inaugurated in January 2021. My main fear, though, is just how rife conspiracy theories are here. I mean, the whole, support for democracy is just not as strong as we once took for granted. I mean, I've spoken to so many people who are not as wacko as you might think when you actually hear them speak, who believe in such nonsense and about how it's all a conspiracy for the Democrats. I mean, I've spoken to people who think Democrats are going to steal the election. Then they're going to topple Joe Biden. Kamala Harris is going to be installed, and she's going to come and install martial law and take away our guns, right? And this person's telling me, and I'm armed and ready for that day. And I'm like, wait, this is just somebody that you kind of bump into. I didn't even have to look hard to speak to her. Okay. So there's some very odd views around.
So Tony and Austin, your day jobs are advising big businesses on how to respond to politics and that kind of thing. The uncertainty, Tony, what would you say about that? It does feel like a lot of people think that Donald Trump is getting his in early.
Just quickly addressing two things that have been said. The violence in the streets right now that we're seeing across America are largely driven by the left. This is, to whatever degree you want to talk about Proud Boys or others, and these are protests, some starting peacefully, that have gotten out of control and are largely being, if not organized and driven by kind of left groups, certainly are being allowed and almost condoned by leftist Democratic mayors and governors, and that's what we're seeing. So I want to make sure we're abundantly clear on that point. Number one, number two, And I'm not a conspiracy theorist either, so don't worry, Sarah. But I do have to say this whole idea that it's really Donald Trump who's throwing the whole notion of what's going to happen on Election Day into turmoil by challenging potential integrity. There's legitimate reason to be concerned. Orson is 100% right. We're seeing humongous volumes of vote by mail, the likes we've not seen before. And they're not counted as they come in. These are all being held, and they're going to start counting them after the election. So there is going to be, by its own definition, a huge delay. As I mentioned before, three previous Democratic nominees refused to concede on election night in much more conventional circumstances than we find ourselves now. So there are going to be very legitimate reasons to be concerned. And here's something else that's happening that may or may not be getting enough attention. Certainly, I'm imagining not overseas. There are reasons for Republicans to believe that there have been efforts to subvert support for the president, not necessarily this election, but based on the last one. We just had our Office of Director of National Intelligence declassify reports that show Hillary Clinton's campaign being heavily involved with an effort to produce a dossier falsely that was then the basis of an FBI investigation that then potentially challenged the idea that Donald Trump's campaign was colluding with the Russians to interfere in the election. That's not only a hoax, largely driven by the media and the left, but this is now actually something that was being driven by our political opponents. The FBI knew, Barack Obama and Joe Biden's administration knew all the details of this as of July of 2016, and they let it go on for almost 2 years. We had the Mueller investigation and the cloud of, quote, Russia hoax. So there is a reason to be very skeptical of the intentions and not have to necessarily be a conspiratorial tin hat wearing person. I would say this on business, which is don't overreact. We're going to have a constitutionally certified election. There are various outcomes. I think if Donald Trump wins, the Republicans keep the Senate, largely because of the whole energy behind the Supreme Court right now, as Orson alluded to. I think if Joe Biden wins, the Democrats likely win the Senate and retain control of the House. So you'll probably have a very big one-party rule for at least the next 2 years. I think that is going to have consequences on tax policy most immediately. I think one of the reasons the New York Times report on the president's taxes had no impact when they did it in 2016 and will likely have no impact this time is people don't really care what the president paid or didn't pay in his taxes. He followed the law, by the way. I mean, I don't think there was an assertion of law breaking, but like every other business person, he finds the way to pay the fewest taxes possible. I mean, you talk about taxes now, we cut them for the first time in 31 years. Under the Biden proposal, you're talking about small business taxes going from 29% under Donald Trump to 40% under Joe Biden. You're talking about the top rate for payroll, payroll and income taxes going from 37% under Trump to 52% under Biden, and the corporate tax rate going from 21% under Trump to up to 28% under Biden. So I think there is going to definitely be massive implications if you're looking on the tax stuff. But again, I don't necessarily think it's a cause of overreaction or over concern, right now, as far as if I'm looking at this as a business person, because again, there's a lot of outcomes that can happen, and I'm sure we're modeling a lot of those things, but we are going to have a thriving democracy and constitution regardless of the outcome, I'm sure.
So Austin, without getting too deep into the politics, businesses are going to be concerned by this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a couple drivers. A lot of my clients are concerned about COVID, probably more importantly than the election, in that, the possibility of the cold and flu season and the second wave, their ability to remain afloat. I think after the election, regrettably, you'll probably see a bunch of announcements on layoffs that, people may have waited politically to make a decision, but...
And you think that's either way?
Yeah, because, 2 days ago, Walt Disneyland, I'm sure you saw that, laid off 30,000 people because people can't travel. They can't visit the Magic Kingdom, and I think airlines and others are going to have some really tough discussions. The thing that, I saw this when I worked in the Clinton White House. I was in charge of the war room during the Bush-Gore election, and I had the responsibility of trying to explain the president who won, and at 4 a.m. I was tongue-tied because I didn't know what the heck was happening. And I think you'll see the same here. The thing that I think that's really scary and the business community can't overreact is Tony rightly pointed out, there are 8 states in the U.S. that won't start counting ballots until Election Day. 4 of those states are battleground states, like Wisconsin, like Pennsylvania, and others. And you think about the percentage of people who are going to vote on those mail-in ballots, and they're just starting to count those ballots and then leaving the polls open, hopefully that we don't have a COVID second wave. People in Wisconsin in a recent special election were waiting 5 hours to vote. And the argument was, if you were in line, you will be able to vote even if the polls close. So even then, this thing could spill over. So, you know, what could create chaos is a lot of the southern states and Florida's, as an example, are states that will probably have on-demand vote counting. And we will know immediately who won. So on election night, you could have the president winning 12 states. And those eight other states who haven't started counting, you have no clue. And then I think that's when the conspiracy theorists come out. That's when the headlines come. That's when a candidate or a campaign may proclaim victory. And that's when, you know, the market could react. So, you know, I tell folks to buckle up.
That's going to
be interesting, right.
Lots of questions coming through and not much time. So let's try and zip through these. Inevitably, a lot of people on this call are from business side of things wanting to know what's going to happen. And also this sense of being at a fork in the road of very different outcomes. So Gail Grant is asking the question, Mark, about the US-UK trade talks and the difference between the two presidents in terms of what will happen there. Have you got a sense of the relationship with the UK depending on who's in charge?
Well, I think the ratification for a US-UK trade deal by the House of Representatives in all scenarios is tough if Boris continues to pursue the line of stepping back from the agreed terms of the divorce settlement. So this is about the treatment of Northern Ireland relative to the rest of the UK. And at the moment, that's, I think, a fundamental problem for many Americans, including, by the way, Joe Biden, Irish-American by heritage. And Democrats, I think, in the House will significantly take advice from the Taoiseach and from the leaders, political leaders in the Irish Republic, about how to think of those. I think that's a first order kind of spanner in the works in terms of a US-UK trade deal being getting through the Congress if the current standoff happens. Now, there's another kind of world of pain about whether that's actually gonna happen or not, or whether this is a negotiating tactic by the Brits with their current negotiations with the EU. But I think that's a straightforward issue. I think the thing that the British people have to accept is the UK does not loom very large. There are all sorts of reasons why Donald Trump himself, his detestation of multinational organizations and all the rest of it, would love and by the way, detestation of the WTO. I mean, those Brits, those pro-Brexit Brits who think the WTO is a kind of, you know, is the kind of safe haven for the future. Donald Trump would like to see the WTO abolished, I think. I think that the path to a US-UK trade deal under all circumstances is a longer one and a more difficult one than many people think. Having said that, as Tony's already pointed out, actually one of the areas of progress and success, and I listened to a seminar with Robert Lighthizer, the American chief trade negotiator, this administration has struck a number of trade deals. So you can't, a Trump administration, second term Trump, you can certainly see trying to do something with the Brits as they have with others. I think it's quite difficult. My reading of the US politics is quite difficult. And with Biden, I think it's a fundamental issue for the UK if they're going to attempt to somehow fudge the Irish stuff to get America to sign a trade deal.
Derever, your sense of what the difference in the terms of the relationship with the UK will be in Biden-Trump?
Well, the good news if Joe Biden wins is that he's sort of for the kind of old school international relations that saw Britain as a key ally, and he'll try and get back to that. But the bad news is he doesn't like Brexit. He's not going to be naturally sympathetic, I don't think, to Boris Johnson. And by Mark is so right. The Irish relationship is so important. Years ago, I went to the British Embassy party to say farewell to Tony Blair. And I thought there'd be a sort of, you know, representative, sort of more or less everybody there. Yeah, there was a bit of smattering of that. But by and large, and you know, it seemed like the overwhelming proportion of guests from Ted Kennedy onwards were all to do with the Good Friday Agreement. They had come to salute the man who had kind of brokered that deal. And they really care about Ireland, Northern Ireland, and the Good Friday Agreement. That's going to be a problem. The problem with Donald Trump is, in theory, he's all for Brexit, but as we know, he's all for America first in trade negotiations as well, and may not be that much of a pushover either.
So Orson and Tony, we're getting a lot of people asking a very similar question. Sean Ryan, Alison Stewart Allen, and Mark Wainwright, basically asking what we can expect in the first 100 days of a Trump or a Biden presidency. Again, very differently. You could spend hours on this, but it could just give us a thumbnail sketch. Orson, let's start with you. What you think we would see that was different under Biden?
Yeah, I mean... I think because, you know, I mentioned earlier the kitchen table issues of COVID, unemployment, crime, healthcare. I think that will be the focus. I think Biden will try to make certain that he lets his supporters know that he heard them. I think Biden is probably someone who's going to give a nod to the labor community. And I think any infrastructure program that he rolls out will be about job creation within the labor community. Having said that, I think that on the foreign policy side, unless there's low-hanging fruit like the Paris Climate Accord or showing up at meetings where Trump might have blown off, you know, his 100 days is going to be about how do we get these jobs back? How do we address the issue of COVID? And the curveball and something to think about is I'm not 1,000% certain if Biden wins that he is interested in reelection. So, you know, the first 100 days for him could be more about legacy items and making certain that he empowers Senator Harris to pick up the baton should she decide to run. So, you know, I think if Biden were to win, you would see kind of an exaggerated, accelerated presidency where he would be looking for quick wins, legacy items early, reversing anything that Trump did that was reflective of rolling back some of the Obama things like ACA and others. And then really solely focusing in on the U.S. Economy and table, you know, kitchen table issues.
So, Tony, one of the popular analyses, which I'm sure you'll disagree with, is that the international institutions have suffered very badly, and that's been a problem because of Trump, and that the Paris Accord was dropped, that kind of thing. Do we expect more of the same in a second Trump presidency or anything different?
Well, I just want to address a little bit about how the president views multinational, multilateral institutions. I was very involved with planning his first trip to Davos in 2018. And, you know, I know there's a misunderstanding of America first. And at that time, you know, our message was America first is in America alone. And the reality is whether or not it works for the international community for 30 years, the United States has had to subordinate its own interests in pursuit of, you know, making it even for everybody else. And that's been achieved in some cases is with our trade relationship with China. China's outperformed us. And when you talk about the WTO, it's not about detesting it and abolishing it. It's about reforming it and making it a much more fair actor and arbiter of international trade disputes than it has been. Look, I think the president understands that these are important institutions, IMF, World Bank, the WTO, et cetera, NATO, and his interest is to just modernize them. You know, the United States helped set up all of these institutions for very important mandates, you know, half a century ago. But since then, they've really fallen far from their meeting their mandates. And our view is that you have to modernize these groups and get them back on track and recalibrate them, not necessarily abolish them. But I just wanted to make sure people understood there is an interest in working through the international community. But if you're NATO, for example, just pay your fair share. The United States is not going to pick up the bill anymore, you know, just without other countries feeling that they have, you know, a reason to invest into the NATO alliance. That all being said, it depends when, for the president, I really think it depends what Congress looks like. If we still have the Senate versus having a completely dominated, you know, Democratic dominated Congress. I will say, and Orson's right, I think both sides are looking at the economy, how to bring the economy back post-COVID. I think, you know, my former boss, Secretary Mnuchin, and the president have, and Mnuchin right now is literally almost as we speak on Capitol Hill negotiating with Nancy Pelosi a fourth coronavirus relief package because of the damage being done to the economy, particularly the small business economy here in the United States, but even big businesses, the airline industries, the energy industry, et cetera. I think you're going to see a lot of emphasis on the economic comeback. And to apply that more internationally, I do think you're going to see a continued emphasis on trade. I don't think there's been a president in my lifetime who's prioritized trade and renegotiating bilateral trade relationships as much as Donald Trump.
And Tony, just very quickly, because we're coming up against time, just one quick question to you. Alice Hunt is saying that Supreme Court nomination, is that a deciding factor for moderate Republicans? Has that helped Trump because it's made people focus on which tribe they're part of? Very briefly.
That's great. Yes, the short answer is absolutely. You know, these things galvanize both sides, but the advantage, I think, as we learned with the Brett Kavanaugh fight, tends to rest on the right, and it will unify even skeptical moderate Republicans around the president.
Very helpful. Okay, we've got 2 minutes left, and I'm going to do something profoundly unfair at the end of the call and go to each members of the panel and ask them to call it, given what they know now. So I'm going to start with you, Mark. Who's going to be the next president?
Well, I said 2 weeks ago, I said I thought it was going to be Donald Trump. And I reserve the right to change my mind. As of today, I think it's getting harder for Trump. I think maybe Biden.
Sarah.
Sort of going the same way. Last week, I was definitely Donald Trump. Now I'm beginning to question my own judgment and think maybe Biden can squeak this thing. But I'm pretty much on the fence, and I'm still out there trying to talk to people and make up my mind.
Fair enough. Awesome.
You know, again, I'm from Wisconsin. It's a big battleground state, and all I have to do is pick up the phone and call friends and relatives. The last go around, they all said Hillary's got problems. Someone needs to visit here shortly. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. This go around, when I make calls home, either they say I've already voted. either they say, you know, things are going well, but I never have heard of late of anyone in Wisconsin complaining about lack of enthusiasm or their support for the candidate on both sides. So having said that, you know, I wouldn't say 100% confident, but feeling as though the scale is leaning towards Biden because states like Wisconsin are being paid attention to. And, you know, rightly or wrongly, I think Trump has brought the Biden out of the basement and are actually fighting for the states. And I think that helps Democrats.
Hey, Tony, if you can.
The silent majority is real. The polls are largely flawed. My sense is I feel better this year than I did in 2016. With almost the same identical map that he won in 2016, with the potential adding of Minnesota and potential loss of Michigan.
Thank you very much to the panel. We won't hold you to it. I want to say a special thank you for getting up so early, all of you. I'm glad to see in the last hour, Sarah's windows have gone from black to very light. It looks very nice there now. You've been an absolutely fantastic panel. I've learned a lot. We can't give you a round of applause, but we all give you a virtual standing ovation and say thank you very much. And we look forward to seeing what happens over the next month. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.